has a beautiful song to get us in that spirit of preparing for God's coming. But I think it's actually a little bit ironic, even as our spirits can get stirred by a lot of the traditional Christmas celebrations, how Advent can be one of the times, again, where our spirits are most uplifted, but the scriptures that we might encounter from the lectionary, that's where they came from this morning, can be some of the most difficult to hear and to preach on, to be honest. Because we're immersing ourselves in the idea of God coming, the hopes of the ancient Israelites, and then thinking about how that relates to ourselves and our own anticipation of God breaking into our lives. But we get verses like today that have hearts that sound very hopeful and hearts that sound very potentially scary and judgmental. That some things might be really good when God shows up and some things might be really difficult. The type of literature that both of these passages are is called apocalyptic literature. And this was a genre, actually, that was common at the time when both of these were written. Not only do we see this in our own Bible, but we see this in other writings at the same time and in the same part of the world where these were written. And I know now we think of the word apocalypse as meaning, like, disaster, end of the world war, right? Like, everything is going horribly. But actually, the original meaning of the word apocalypse is much more simple and less foreboding. It just means revealing. And that was the idea of apocalyptic literature as well, that writers felt like they were revealing something that might have been hidden from people otherwise, and that God was helping them do that revealing. It didn't necessarily always mean, though, that it was just about revealing something in the future. So I'll let you know that my personal interpretation of apocalyptic literature, from what I've studied and what I learned in seminary and how I've worked with other communities, is that this revealing is a revealing for the way things always are, but we may each have specific times and seasons in our lives where it is especially true. And so, at the time that this was written, there were things that the writers had especially in mind that was being revealed about the day of the Lord. It would be other empires coming to conquer Israel and Judah in the Old Testament. It would be the Romans decimating Jerusalem at the writing of the New Testament. And they also, though, would have had in mind that hopefully this would have meaning for other people in the future. So we now also recognize the meaning for how it can be ultimately in the future for when Jesus comes. But we can also see, perhaps, in different seasons of our lives when God shows up and shows us something, gives us hope when we didn't have it before, or maybe even sometimes gives us conviction when we weren't seeing something going not quite right that we should have. And I know that there may be a lot of different opinions and theologies about this in the church, but feel free to talk to me more about it. I know that these are some of the most complicated and difficult scriptures to wrap our minds around and to get into and see how they work out in our lives. Right? And again, we're stuck in particular with that tension of the day of the Lord, Jesus coming being announced, is lifted up as being full of hope, full of deliverance, full of freedom, on the one hand, but on the other hand, potentially full of judgment, full of loss, full of pain, if we're not connected with God in the right way. And those two sides of things, of God showing up, is sort of where we get to that, how does hope maybe become, be careful what you wish for? I think I've spoken with many of you. Some of you may not know this. Over Thanksgiving, the last few days, I went on a road trip to go to Wisconsin to visit family for Thanksgiving. Got the two little ones, like an 8-hour drive at least. That's not a fun time necessarily to be cooped up. So we rely, like many parents do now, on tablets, phones, Netflix, which Disney Plus just came out, right? So we're like, here we go. We can download a bunch of those movies. We'll keep them busy. They won't feel quite as bored and messed up. And it's fascinating when you start to immerse yourself in the stories of our culture, or really any culture, how almost any story of a hope or a wish has an element of it, of be careful what you wish for. And Disney movies are perfect for this, right? We've got, like, Snow White, the witch, wants to be the most beautiful and thinks that she can control Snow White, but then be careful what you wish for. It may not turn out the way that you think. Sleeping Beauty, the family wants to protect Sleeping Beauty from the whole, and the whole kingdom from potentially going to sleep. They think that they're able to protect her, and then it turns out that they're not, and they have to go through all sorts of a rigmarole to get to her too. Beauty and the Beast, Belle sings about wanting more than this provincial life, and she's got to go be kidnapped by a beastly creature. Aladdin thinks he can only find love with Jasmine by becoming a sultan, and not just who he is. In The Lion King, Simba sings, "I just can't wait to be king," and a few scenes later, his father dies. So many stories where we think we know what we want, but what's actually going on ends up being a lot more complicated. Maybe to get us in the mood for the Christmas musical coming up, I found this in a book, a Chicken Soup for the Soul book, Christmas edition. Same idea. There's a little girl who really wanted to be the lead to be Mary in her Christmas play at her church. She practiced not only that part, but all of the parts in the whole play to be ready. And she had been growing out her hair since the summer in anticipation of it because she thought, if I have my beautiful blonde hair, then everyone will see me and think that must be Mary. And they'll want me to be cast in the part. So she tries out, and then in the time between when she tries out and she thinks she does great, and the cast is announced, there's a breakout of lice at her house. And her mom has to cut her hair incredibly short, and she actually takes herself out of the running because she feels like I'd be too embarrassed to have this haircut, and everyone will be looking at me, and I won't look good even if I go to the party. So she helps out behind the scenes, still remembers all of the parts as she goes along, says them to herself as she's listening to everyone else rehearse, and then the night before the play, at dress rehearsal, Joseph is not there. And everyone's panicking, and it turns out that Joseph's family also had a breakout of lice. And so he had to have his head shaved, and he also now is mortified and doesn't want to play a part in the play at all. And the director asks, "What are we going to do? It's tomorrow. We need to have somebody play Joseph. Boys, is there anyone here who knows the part?" They all just kind of stand there sheepishly staring at their shoes. The little girl pipes up and says, "I learned all the parts when I wanted to try out for Mary." And so she turns out to be the lead in the Christmas play after all, but playing Joseph. And so sometimes even those "be careful what we wish for"s can have not just we thought we wanted something good, then there was a bad side of it, but even the bad side can turn into something. And I think we can see some of this in our passages today as well, and we can take a lot of meaning from that. Both of the passages, and especially when we put them in conversation with each other, which, by the way, I think is appropriate, because Jesus had in mind whenever he was teaching his disciples the prophetic tradition that he was a part of. And the fact that we see a lot of parallel imagery, parallel wording, is because Jesus would have had these same types of passages in mind and was trying to step into them, expand the meaning of them for his disciples. So, for Jesus' teaching in particular, and far be it for me, by the way, to be a literary critic of God in flesh, but when I read the passage in Matthew, it seems a little bit strange on first blush, because Jesus mixes his metaphors like crazy. Is God the thief in the night and we are the owners of the house? Or later in the passage it continues on and God becomes the owner of the homestead that returns and finds servants either being faithful or being unfaithful, and the faithful servants are rewarded and the unfaithful servants are punished? So So is when this happens, is God a thief, a savior, an owner? As we meet God, are we servants? Are we owners? It can feel very convoluted. But actually, I think it turns out to be very profound. Because with that revealing can always be applicable understanding of apocalyptic literature, we understand that it's not always just that all of the bad people will get one result and all of the good people will get one result only when God comes one time. But that each of us have within ourselves parts of our life and parts of our reality and parts of our experience, parts of how we're growing and developing, that God breaking in gives us hope and empowerment and encouragement. And we can see more and more fruit come from that. But we also have parts of ourselves that God showing up will be like iron striking iron. It might be painful to have God work on that with us. We might have to be honest about some things in ourselves that we don't always want to see and admit. But it's still important that we work through them, even if there's judgment as a part of that. I think a big part of how that ends up coming in is another element of the passages, which is that they both undermine our traditional expectations of success and worth. In the Isaiah passage, the extended part that I asked Kate to read in verses 6 through 11 talks about how Israel has so much money and treasure. Israel has so many horses and chariots. Israel has so many gods and works of their hands. And those are the things that actually bring Israel judgment. And yet those could also be the things that we might relate to Israel and say, when I'm trying to show that I've got it all together for God, I say, look at all the things that I've been successful at. Look at all the ways I have power and influence and I'm ready to act on something. Look at all the solutions that I've come up with from other sources in the world around me. And how ready I am. I almost barely need you, God, because I worked so hard to be ready without you. And the same thing is true of the servants in the Matthew passage. Some of the servants are trying to make it look as if everything's fine, and then they don't have to worry about it. They can go and party, basically, is what the passage says. And then the owner comes back and says, what are you doing? It's not as good as you thought it was. You tried to make it look nice. But it was all facade. While other servants were quietly, diligently working, maybe not as showy, God comes back, maybe doesn't see as much flash initially, but sees them authentically and faithfully doing what really needs to be done, and they're the ones that are rewarded. Throughout the Bible, God especially holds up those tensions of how things seem to be and then how things are when God shows up. Often there's this tension between empires, the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire in the Old Testament, the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus, seem to have all the power, seem to have all the wealth, seem to have all the glory, seem like everything was going to work out, so maybe you need to do things like that in order to get the results that you want. But God consistently says that there will be another way when God shows up. Spears and swords and the plowshares and the pruning hooks. Reconciliation on the mountain, not God's army smiting all of the other armies. And that brings us to parallels again of agricultural imagery in both passages. The plowshares and pruning hooks in Isaiah. The servants out getting the harvest in the Matthew passage. It makes me wonder if one of the people out in the field, if one of the people at the millstone is taken by God and one is left To some of you, what direction between spears and swords and plowshares and pruning hooks were those servants inclined towards? I could see myself being a servant out in the field. Maybe I'm supposed to be getting the harvest, but I'm thinking, you know, that servant back at the house that really ticked me off, I could use this plowshare and really get him if I wanted to. Or maybe there's a servant who was a soldier before got a job in the field and had to turn the sword into a pruning hook. Where are our priorities as we prepare ourselves for God? One of the ways that I think we're all going to be especially mindful of this tension of hope, be careful what you wish for. Are we excited to see God come into our lives? Are we nervous about seeing God come into our lives? Here at the holiday season, we're mindful of family. We're traveling to see family. We remember good times with family in the past. And whether it's when you're getting married, getting ready to have kids, or just going through different life stages with family members, we can have a romanticism about those seasons of life. I can't wait to get married. It's going to be amazing. Spend my rest of my life with this person. It's going to be perfect all the time. Kids, it's going to be so beautiful. We're going to run around and have fun, and we're going to have little me, and it's going to be great, right? Or what it's like to transition between, you know, having kids, teenagers, to then adult children, or parents getting older, needing different types of care. We can have a hope about it, but then I saw many of you sort of snickering at me about what I was saying about that romantic side. We know that sometimes it can lead to disillusionment if we puff ourselves up. And so family is one of the places where both parts of ourselves can come out like that the most. How many of you have had moments where you've interacted with family and said, huh, I never knew that about myself? Something in an interaction you got to have revealed a part of you that was really neat and encouraging and you could be proud of. What about having a feeling, ugh, I never knew that about myself? Those times when we have our interactions, like, where did that come from? That was not good. It all comes out. And yet our temptation in those moments can be to puff up the good things and to hide and deny the bad things. But I think most of us know that when we do those, we're actually setting ourselves up for even more difficulty with our family and with ourselves and how we continue to develop with people. But when we share the good things, and when we trust those around us to help us work through the bad things, that's where family really gets its full meaning. If we're willing to bring it before those who love us and support us and care for us and want the best for us, you can say, yeah, I am really not knowing what's going on with that, but it needs to change. And it might be hard, it might be embarrassing, it might be difficult to get through. And that can feel like judgment. But out on the other side, that's some of the most hopeful experiences that we can have. And that, I think, is really what's at the heart of what Jesus is trying to say, and what Isaiah is trying to say about how God breaks into our lives. We have profound hope in really positive ways, and we have profound hope even in the midst of judgment and fear. Embarrassment. So we're striving to be a church family. We're striving to extend our spirit of family and community to those around us. How can we be this type of family for each other? How can we be faithful servants, people of hope, rather than people of empire? And by the way, the Matthew passage extends. Jesus keeps talking for a while. You guys are used to that now because you deal with me and my sons. To a very familiar passage in Matthew 25, where Jesus talks about where you served those in prison, clothed those who were cold, fed and gave water to those who were hungry and thirsty. That's where you met Jesus, even if you didn't know him. And so all these things that we can do, not only will we find hope for ourselves, will we share hope with others, but we can count on encountering Jesus. So the first lesson for me in these passages is, how do we find ways to let go of our chasing and striving and thinking that resources or might or pride and power, the way that the world measures it, is the way that everything is going to be fine for us? Passages say that those things will be what ends up crumbling. And so we need the foundation of connection with God and loving support of each other to last through them. Again, just be careful what you wish for. Stories teach us the same thing. The girl thought that her beautiful hair was going to be what made her great in the play. And instead, it was her character being prepared and ready to do something, even if maybe at first she would have never wanted to be Joseph. All of our Disney characters, right? There's that sense of let go of the posturing and be your real self and let your relationships support you, and you'll be what really is best. We also need to be ready to seek the peace of reconciliation rather than eradication. Many of us have heard in school about the Pax Romana. That was the time of Jesus. The whole world was conquered. There was no more fighting anymore, because the Roman boot was on everybody's neck. They couldn't do any fighting. And that was called peace. But our Prince of Peace talks about all the nations coming to the mountain and God reconciling them. It's easy for us when we think about our own opponents, people that we clash with in our families, people on Facebook or Twitter, people we disagree with. We could just have that perfect comeback so they'd be completely silenced and shamed. Or just got to get as much space from those people as possible. And I don't want to argue for the idea of the removal of healthy boundaries that we need to cope with them. That's fine. But we should ultimately seek and expect and hope that God will be a force for reconciliation rather than eradication, just getting rid of those that we're having trouble with. And so ultimately all of that goes back to our efforts to strive to be faithful for each other and faithful with God. Even if it seems like the ways that we are doing that don't have any of the normal markers of success and influence and security, it could be easy for us to say, if only we had this many more thousands of dollars in our coffers, if only we had, you know, this thing in our building, if only we had this type of person around, or whatever it might be. We can probably think of some similar things in your own lives. But that would solve everything. But these passages remind us that our connection with God really and truly is the ultimate good in and of itself. And even if some things that we look for don't end up being there, that doesn't mean that God is not with us, and it doesn't mean that we don't have a beautiful life to share together and with others. And focusing on that, faithfully lived out, is the most important thing that will bring the most fruit. And so, to help anchor us in that, this week we have an ultimate expression of connection with God, and that's coming to the communion table together.